Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this specialist series, Explore How to Plan an Expedition, a series created for the Royal Geographical Society. I'm Matt Pycroft, an expedition specialist, filmmaker and photographer, and I've been going on expeditions under various banners for 15 years. I also sit on the council of the RGS. Episode 10 of our specialist series, Explore How to Plan an Expedition, continues our Camp Life mini-series, where we speak to a single individual about a specific type of expedition environment. In this mountains episode, our guest is John Gupta. We talk about navigation, food and water, coping with altitude sickness, and whether or not to use a guide. We also discuss the value in taking a couple of luxuries onto the peaks. After all, any fool can suffer. John is a mountaineering and climbing instructor and high altitude expedition guide. He's organized and led over 100 major expeditions around the world, including to Everest 4 times, K2, a winter ascent of Denali, and the 7 summits. Finally, if you're looking for support with planning your own expedition or field research project, then head to rgs.org to begin the journey. Right, let's get started with episode 10 of How to Plan an Expedition. So let's start at the start. Please can you introduce yourself and give us an overview of your experience in mountain environments?
My name's John Gupta and I live in North Wales currently, and I work mostly as a mountaineering and climbing instructor, but I also do a huge amount of expeditions. And whilst they started in the jungles, they have predominantly or almost entirely been based around mountains and high altitude mountains, more specifically, for the last, well, nearly 2 decades now.
Ace, and I think it's really important early on to kind of talk about the vastly different scales and styles of mountain and mountaineering out there. When we say mountaineering, we can mean quite a few different things, you know, from the Kulim Ridge through to the Alps, through to like unclimbed 7,000 meter peaks. What's the difference? I realize that's a big question.
So I often, in my head, would define climbing as things which are pitched, which is where it's very slow and one climber goes first, builds an anchor, the second climber follows, and then they regroup and repeat. And that can be numerous pitches to get wherever you want to go. Or mountaineering often is the layer just below that, where there's more of a continual journey or more movement and less pitching, or just only occasional little tiny bits. So in my eyes, mountaineering is sort of the gap between sort of hill walking, if you like, or trekking and climbing. And so therefore it's vast. You know, it's anything from perhaps scrambling where you might use a rope through to sort of glacial travel, through to moving up huge ridges in the Himalayas, or whatever it might be. I think mountaineering probably encompasses an enormous array. And I think it'd be very fair for a lot of people to say that they're mountaineers or that they go mountaineering. And I think the term climbing often gets misused. You know, you don't climb up Kilimanjaro, you trek up Kilimanjaro. You definitely don't mountaineer up Kilimanjaro either. So that was kind of like a way of separating it. But again, it doesn't bother me if somebody wants to say I climbed up Snowdon today, and by that they mean they had an amazing journey up the Clamberis path, then fine, if that's what that means to them. But I think on sort of paper in my head, climbing involves ropes and pitching, and mountaineering involves sort of moving quicker over complex terrain, and hill walking is having no technical equipment with you whatsoever.
So let's talk specifics, and I'll kind of just throw them at you one at a time. We can go through them in detail. And I think before we do, actually, it's worth saying, you know, I'm interested in your view on the crossover between skills and technology. And I think this first question gives us an opportunity to really talk about that a little bit as well. So when it comes to navigation, you know, how do you navigate in mountainous terrain? What makes it challenging? What specialist equipment do you need? And can that specialist equipment replace skill?
Navigating in a mountainous environment can be both sort of very straightforward and also really, really, really difficult. And I think the main thing that catches folk out is that how quick the environment can change. So you might just be pootling along up, say, Penivan in the Brecon Beacons, and it's reasonably nice. And then within, you know, within a short period of time, the clouds have rolled in, and you know, if the path sort of just fizzles out a little bit momentarily, you can very, very quickly and very easily get disorientated and then, you know, off route. And then it's like, well, do I have the ability to get myself back on route? Now, tech these days, I would say, is pretty amazing. And I'd have to say, put my hand up and say that, you know, when I'm up working in Scotland, I carry a map and a compass each day that I go out. But I think last season I'd never used it. I either knew the mountains well enough to just sort of go without navigating, or was able to just sort of look at my phone very briefly and then, you know, follow a blue dot, for example, to just to a point where I needed to go. But it's difficult for me to suggest that that's the best way, because I'm using that on top of a layer of extensive experience and qualifications. So it's an additional tool to knowledge and experience. So I've discussed this quite a lot with various other instructors and guides and stuff, but I firmly believe that there is no substitute for being able to competently read a map and compass, because you can do that in nighttime. You can do it in a whiteout and it will work because the map is correct. So I would say that investing some skills, even if it's just at a basic level with an instructor or with a center, to just understand at least the basics of map work. And then it's actually quite fun. I know it sounds like a bit of a oldie, beardy, weirdy kind of hobby to go map reading, but it's incredibly rewarding. And it's very, very comforting to know that I can then go out into the wilderness or into the mountains and push myself, knowing that if needs be, I can get the map and compass out and I can relocate myself, and then I can get myself out of Dodge or back down to wherever I need to be. So I think there's a space for both. I think, and I still think that tech probably comes second to maps and compasses. So I think in summary, skills outweigh tech, but tech is a very, very useful and very relevant tool. But you also need to know how to use your tech.
So water and food. I think let's start with on this, you know, sometimes there's snow, sometimes there isn't. If there isn't, what do you need to carry? And if there is, how do you make it drinkable?
A lot of the mountains that I do sort of in colder environments, obviously we have snow and ice, so we can melt that into water. Other places where water is more sparse, or you're having to sort of get it out of sort of really heavily silted glacial streams and that sort of thing, then there's kind of two things that I would look to do. One is to try and filter it in some capacity to take out all the little bits and pieces. But probably more important than that is to have some sort of purification system or ability. Now, I've used SteriPens quite a bit and I think they're fantastic. Like they're quite efficient and you can share them between a group quite easily. But obviously they need some sort of power source or batteries. And the other that I use the majority of the time is just tiny little drops. So even if the water looks clean, if I'm somewhere a bit unusual, I'd probably still do that, because getting sort of water-based illnesses is never fun. And, you know, if you have like coffee filters or you've got an AeroPress or whatever, you can do all sorts of weird things to push water through filters. You just need some filter paper. I have used a sock before, a clean one, I must add. I think you might have even put two socks in and then put water through. That was just to get loads of sediment out. And it worked. They're still like brown and dirty, but it had less sediment in it. And then we purified it and drank it and had no dramas. But I would say for me personally, like 99% of the time, I'm either just scooping water out of streams and drinking it straight away, like here in the mountains in Wales or in the lakes. Like if I'm more than like 50 meters from the road, I just drink it straight out of the stream and it's beautiful.
Yeah, and it can be tempting. I mean, you seem to be more on it than me with this, but it can be tempting not to do it. Like just 6 weeks of an expedition, you just think, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to sit here pumping something or put more iodine in my drink. You know, I just have something that tastes nice for a change, please.
Well, old Robinson's squash do those little tiny, they've got a funny name, I can't remember, like super concentrated squash that's like literally the size of your palm, maybe smaller. So I take those on my trips now. And they taste nice anyway. But if you have had to put some chlorine or purification tablets in there that don't taste great, although the ones I use don't taste of anything, but if you have some that don't taste great, then you can disguise that with a little bit of squash and you're off, you're laughing.
There's an off-script point to make there, I think, which is a really good one. You know, like burly mountaineer and guide takes Robinson's squash on his trips. It's like, well, any fool can suffer. You know, you don't need to be pretending to be Robert Falcon Scott on your way to die in the Antarctic.
No, I mean, when I was young, I was all about like light is right and cutting labels out my clothes and popping paracetamol out of wrappers. Nowadays, I take down slippers, a blow-up pillow most of the time, unless I'm climbing what would be for me like hard routes in a sort of alpine style, then I wouldn't take all those things. But on all these expeditions, there is a value in comfort to a degree.
I think, yeah, and I think it's huge, actually. So when you do get in that tent and it's been a bit miserable and you quite fancy having some warm squash and watching Netflix, well, off you go.
It's, yeah, exactly that. And I was a bit annoyed at myself, actually. On the last Himalayan trip I did, I thought, for a number of reasons, I was going to have to carry quite a lot of stuff. So I thought I'd take a smaller Therm-a-Rest. Such a mistake. On Himalayan big high altitude trips, you spend hours in your tent. Like you're wrapped up, fed, watered, toothbrushed. That's not even a word. You've brushed your teeth and it's like 6 p.m. And then you've set the alarm for like 7 a.m. and you're like, right, so for the next 13 hours, I'm just going to lie down. So that's when actually having a nice, comfortable sleeping system is invaluable.
So I think let's focus the food chat on expedition specifically. Give us an overview of how it works. I mean, it's obvious why it's important, but why it's so important in the mountains, high altitude, high intensity, etc.
Food's a really interesting one. So water's pretty simple. Somewhere you will attain liquid and you need to get it in you because it's super important to stay hydrated when you're out doing activity, especially on high altitude mountains. It's really, really important to be hydrated. And, you know, just existing in this environment requires a lot of energy to stay warm and just move and everything. So I don't know what your average recommended calorie intake would be, but it would have to be like another 1,000 calories more than sitting around at sea level. So maybe like 3,500. And it's not always that easy. You know, one of the common things that happens to many, many folk when they go to altitude is that they lose their appetite a little bit, especially during the early acclimatization days. So then it's hard to get calories in. So there's definitely a calorie deficit most days. So try like thinking carefully about food is really important. And I often say to folk who are coming on trips with me, like I sort most of the food out and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I always say, think about what you know that you could eat when there's nothing else left in the world that you fancy eating and bring a little bit of that. And that's what you'll probably eat on summit day or on the odd evening when you just really don't want dinner. But yeah, food on expedition. So for the high altitude trips, there's a number of layers here. There's often a trek of some sort, which nowadays is often based in tea houses. So we can sort of be fed on that journey at the tea houses. And there's always going to be sort of rice and curries and stuff like that available, which are fantastic, obviously. But nowadays you can often be a bit more fussy. They usually have potatoes, which you can chop and change however you wish to have those and pastas and that sort of thing. So we can usually be fed reasonably well on the trek in, and it can be a little bit individualized. So, you know, we don't have to all eat the same when, you know, a meal comes out and that's what you get. So at base camp, again, there'll be plenty of food, and it would have been carried in on porters or mules or yaks to base camp. And you can often get resupplies as well, so you can get fresh fruit and veg. So yeah, base camp food can be really nice. And then obviously leave the luxury of base camp and go up into the environment that you're there to go and do, and, you know, whether that's field research remotely or to a climbing objective or a peak or whatever. And then having done a vast amount of high altitude trips, I can no longer eat freeze-dried meals. I just cannot do it, which is a real shame because they seem to have come along quite well recently. And there's a company called Firepot, I think, that a lot of my clients quite enjoy. And there's quite a few others that seem to be trying really hard to make them palatable. And of course, there's the classic old like beans and meatballs from like Wayfarer and stuff. So nowadays, it depends on the trip. And I actually operate mostly on a sort of low key one-to-one. So I sit down with the folk that I work with in the big mountains and we talk about this. I'm like, what do you like? What don't you like? And it goes all the way through to doing really fun stuff like 21 on Dalagiri. We were at high camp at 7.4 and I'd got some sort of chapatis made at base camp like 2 days earlier and had those sort of wrapped up. And then I had some chorizo and some onion and garlic and some cheese that I'd sort of brought up from base camp. So just sort of fried up the onion and the garlic and threw the chorizo in and then just put it in these little wraps and handed them to the client. And it was just like the best thing in the universe. I mean, it wasn't 800 calories packed into a freeze-dried bag, but it was morale through the roof and food in the tummy, which makes a huge difference.
Yeah, it's one of those things that like anybody who's listening who's experienced this will know, and those who haven't, you know, this is, I mean, I think it's part of the reason to go is like that first mouthful of something like that after a couple of weeks of not having it or after a really hard day, it is unsurpassed. Like that feeling of, you know, community camaraderie of we just did a thing and now we're all gonna eat these things together. And sometimes that's as simple as peanut butter in a wrap.
I go shopping before I go, you know, the usual supermarkets here, and then I take out quite a lot of food from the UK. So it depends what country I'm going to, what I can get in country. But you know, we just got the usual like various nuts and dried fruit and various bits and bobs. And as ridiculous as it sounds, like familiarity with a brand is almost something. So you could hand them like a fake chocolate bar and it won't taste as good. So food is really important, but you do need some calories. And I think it's variety as well. And often what can happen on these high altitude trips is that you end up with a lot of sweet stuff and a lot of sort of sugary stuff. So I try hard, bring some like, for those that eat meat, you know, dried biltong and that sort of thing, or pepperamis, or you know, dried fruit and nuts and all sorts of, and cheese, lots of cheese. Cheese is really good, and it lasts really well. Especially if you've got it like covered in wax, you can just like it's flipping brilliant. So cheese and crackers and pate and so. But one thing that also is everything is soft and like doesn't require much chewing or sort of crunch. So if you came on a trip with me, you would soon realize that I'm never that far away from a tub of Pringles. So there's like a really nice sort of salty, crunchy, dry texture that's very, very different to the sort of warm, soft smush of everything else.
But just listening to you talk about it and having experienced it a lot myself, like, I think the main point to making conclusion to this section on food is how important it is actually and how underplayed it is, particularly when you're getting into the game of expeditions and field work and just getting out on trips that are longer than, say, a week. And I think it's, you know, I have a little rule on trips I'm sort of leading or organizing, which is if you're not involved in the decision-making process around food, you're not allowed to comment on it because it's just one of those things where I think you should always be asked and ask other people if you're the one doing it. But if somebody says, I'm not interested, then they've got what they've got. And when whoever's organized it has only brought, you know, peanut butter flavor granola bars for your hill food every day, well, you didn't comment. So don't say anything. And my point is, even if you've delegated these tasks, you're in charge of logistics, you're in charge of risk, you're in charge of food, get involved in the ones that matter to you, right? I always have a lot to say about food, regardless of my role. Okay, altitude sickness is one of the biggest risks in the mountains, especially above 2,500 meters. What is it and what can you do when it strikes?
High altitude sickness, in essence, is a lack of oxygen to your body. And something that's really, I'm really always really keen to sort of clear up is that as you gain altitude, you know, up 4, 5, 6, 7,000, the content of oxygen in the atmosphere doesn't change at all. It's still the same as at sea level. Basically, the top of Everest is the same percentage oxygen as there is at sea level. The thing that changes is the air pressure. So as you go up to altitude, you just get a little bit less of everything. So when you take a big lung full of air, there are just less particles of each element. So you get less oxygen in effect. So it's the air pressure that changes, not the oxygen content, but by proxy, the amount of oxygen you get goes lower. And that has a funny effect on human beings. So there's a whole sort of list. Well, there's like a hierarchy. So the first thing that happens is that folk can get what we call AMS, or acute mountain sickness. And there are a number of sort of telltale signs of that. Things like feeling nauseous, or maybe even vomiting. Headaches is super common. Additional lethargy to what you'd expect having done that sort of exertion. Loss of appetite is really common. Broken sleep is super common, not being able to sleep very well. So those sorts of things, like, they're not like red alarm bells, like go down, but they definitely need to be acknowledged and recognized as sort of symptoms of going to altitude. Now, I often say to clients, like, if you have got one of those or maybe two of those, then that's okay. You know, just see what you can do about it. It might be that you're a little bit dehydrated, or you need to go and have a little lie down, or you've had too much sun. You know, there's usually a reason, as well as being at altitude, and it can be quite easily sort of sorted out. But if you start collecting them, like, you know, playing cards, then we need to have a little chat about this and just see if there's a problem or what's going on. And usually it might just mean, right, we need to just hold tight for a day or so, have a rest, let your body catch up, and then we'll carry on. In sort of more extreme cases, it would mean sort of maybe descending back to where you last felt good, maybe having an extra day there and then going back up to see how you feel. But more often than not, when people, it's usually at the end of the day, people feel a bit ropey, you know, some hydration, maybe some paracetamol, a little rest, some food, and people bounce back around super quick. You know, the early days, that's quite common. And then above that, sort of the layer above, you then have two sort of quite serious conditions, I guess. One's called HACE and one's called HAPE. So high altitude pulmonary edema and high altitude cerebral edema. So pulmonary would be, in short, sort of buildup of fluid on your lungs, and cerebral would be a buildup of fluid in your head, both of which are quite serious. They sound quite serious, and if untreated, can be incredibly serious and could result in sort of passing out and dying if completely untreated. But the good news is, like, similar to AMS, they're also quite easy to treat and quite quick to respond as well if you do something about it. And the short answer with all of these things is to descend, which effectively means increasing your oxygen. So descent if you can, and if you can't, get oxygen if you have that. Oxygen is unbelievably good, which sounds like a really silly thing to say, but having been at altitude a lot and seen some sick people, when they get administered oxygen, it is miraculous how much better they feel very quickly. And there's also a number of drugs like dexamethasone, nifedipine, Diamox, that sort of thing, that if you know what they're for and how to use them, they can be very, very useful with some of those conditions. So that was like a really brief overview. But if you feel like crap, then my advice is to stop immediately and consider retreating, going back down to where you last felt good, and just taking stock and just sort of checking in a little bit.
And on the basis that prevention is better than cure, there are loads of helpful guidelines on how best to prepare for altitude and planning the duration of expedition. And whilst we don't have time to go into this in detail today, loads of this information is available online. I suppose the main thing to do is look at exactly where you're going and understand the height of your plan route and the height you'll sleep at each night. As a rule of thumb, you want to basically walk high and then sleep as low as you can. So often in higher altitude environments, people will be setting up base camps or a series of advanced base camps, Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, etc. Naturally, the purpose is to be increasing how high you're going each day, but you want to head back down to sleep if possible. I think this is probably a really good place to talk about guides and when we should use them and why, when we're thinking about expeditions for recreation or expeditions for fieldwork and science.
I think using guides and sort of local guides as well is invaluable to get the most out of trips. And it doesn't mean that you're incompetent or that you're not good at what you do. It means that you value the time that you're going to be in that environment and you want to make the most out of it. So, you know, a really good example of this is, you know, on the jungle trips I did when I was young, I had my ML and I knew how to pack a bag and I knew how to camp and pitch a tent and cook on a stove and a fire and all these sorts of things. But I could have gone and winged it through the jungle, but I had such a better experience by having a couple of local village jungle experts with me who could add to what I knew, which wasn't actually very much at all, but so add to the environment. They could teach me about the forest and what I could eat and the water and what's in there and I could catch and any dangers and things like that within that environment. And there's always an opportunity to learn. If you transfer that into the mountain environment, you know, even if you know quite a lot and you've been in the environment quite a lot, you will always, I think, almost without exception, learn a huge amount from having highly qualified people around you. And it's something that, you know, I'm a reasonably high level qualification now, and I'm still seeking opportunities to learn. And they come from people who are more qualified than I am and have more experience. And I love those opportunities to go out with those people. So if I was going out, you know, field studying or, you know, whatever in Antarctica or into the big mountains, having somebody else that I could offset, say, I want you to manage weather and risks and logistics, and I'm just going to manage this. Like, I'm going to manage the clients, for example. I'm going to look after them. I'm going to work with them really closely, make sure they're happy. And if you could do the safety stuff or whatever it might be, it means you can just get on with why you're there in a much better capacity. And I fully get that a lot of people are like, no, I don't need a guide. You know, I'm super experienced, all the rest of it. And that may be fine. It might actually be that you want a more remote and more sort of self-led trip, and that's what you're looking for, and that's awesome. And I would really encourage people to do that as well. Like, I think a mix of both is really good. And when I was starting out, I went and self-organized and self-led, guided, whatever, with some friends, and we made loads of mistakes, but we were like a little group of friends and we worked together really well. And we tried to choose objectives that were challenging, but probably attainable. So not ridiculous objectives like I often go to now, but ones that we could probably do if we didn't completely screw it up. And we did make lots of mistakes, but none of them were going to be sort of life-changing or super dangerous. And we progressively added to that each year. We went on new trips to new places and slowly built that up. We didn't just sort of launch into sort of crossing the whole of the South Pole single-handedly, you know, on our own. We would start really small, and then in between the big trips, we would upskill as well and go and practice in Scotland and in the lakes and stuff. And it was just an amazing journey through the sort of learning path. But that path can be very gradual and very slow if you do it all yourself, or it can just be gently sort of encouraged and progressed quicker if you seek the help of others who are more experienced.
Totally. And you're actually kind of speaking to and giving conclusions for stuff we've discussed in earlier episodes in this series, because, you know, one of the biggest questions is, why are you going? What are you going to do? And if the answer is, I would like to be guided up a big Himalayan peak because I want to stand on top of it and I want to experience climbing it, okay, that's fine. You know, if you want to go and do a piece of scientific research in a remote jungle somewhere, take a guide. Like, even if you know what you're doing, take a guide, because then you can focus on the science. Don't think about anything else. I mean, I, you know, as a film director, spent 15 years going on mountaineering expeditions, I always have a safety team because I do not want to have to think about rope work. I just don't want to think about it. But when I go out for fun with my mates or go on trips for myself, which I don't do much of anymore, I want to have to think about that because I want to keep my skills hot and I want to learn. And yeah, it's like, ask yourself why you're going, I think is your point, and what you want to get out of it. And let's talk a little bit about kit then. So, you know, we're not going to get into the nuance of whether or not you need really sharp technical front points on your crampons on, you know, Lotsy, but what are the general rules for buying and packing gear for mountaineering expeditions, and what are the mistakes you always see?
I would say this is quite an easy one for me. I would say the most important thing is having kit that you know. Like, if you turn up with loads of shiny new kit that's really good for the job, great. But if you don't really know how that fits on your boot or where the zips are on that jacket or just how warm that layer is and how many other layers you need, it's no use. Like, I'd much rather you turned up with kit that's loved and really well used and that you know inside out. It'd be good if that kit was appropriate to the objective as well, obviously. But yeah, having kit that you know the limitations of, how far you can push it and what it can do for you, is the most important thing. And I love getting geeky with kit. I don't sit around with my scales anymore weighing it, but just things like, you know, on my big expedition down jacket, all the toggles that come with it at the manufacturing shop are just quite small and quite difficult to manage in mittens. So I will get a load of sort of 2 or 3 mil cord and make like 4-inch toggles that I can open and close with mitts on in minus 30 at 8,000 meters. And then for me, that's just like, zip goes down, water bottle comes out, water goes down my mouth, back in, zip up. And then I look around and you see other people like desperately trying to like claw at their pocket to open it, or they have to take their glove out and compromise, you know, cold hands in a very cold environment. And that seems like such a small thing, but it makes a huge difference, because I could harp on for an hour about how important hydration is and all the little minuscule things that I've learned and done to adapt the way I do things in order to make life convenient so that you're more likely to do it. So I have this phrase that I instill in all my clients, which is be bothered. And I basically just keep punching that into them until they understand that. And it goes across all the things. And my classic anecdote for this is that you wake up in the middle of the night in your tent and it's really cold and it's windy and it's really cold. You don't want to get out of your sleeping bag, but you need a wee. So you have a choice. You lie there for the next 2 hours thinking about the fact that you need a wee, or you just go, poof, be bothered, get straight up. Whether it's in a pee bottle or you have to get out of the tent, I don't care. Get out, do it. It's never as bad as you think, ever. And then you won't even remember getting back in your sleeping bag and going back to sleep. So that's like a really good example of be bothered, because when it's cold and miserable, you don't want to get out of your sleeping bag. But that phrase, I can push that through almost everything at high altitude. And quite annoyingly, it's crept into my everyday life. I don't really have life ethoses and philosophies as such, but time and time and time again, I come back to the old phrase of short-term loss, long-term gain. And I'm yet to prove that wrong. And it basically is be bothered. That's the same thing. Short-term loss, long-term gain. Every single time it works, and it just is the way forward. Like, I have never managed to disprove that.
Yeah. And so campcraft is one of the other big things we haven't talked about. And again, you know, we could each write a book on it. We could each do 4 hours on our opinions on it. What are the main things to know about camping and campcraft in mountainous environments that you think are important to know?
Just being a little bit organized. When I'm in my tent, things have a place. And that just means that when I need something, I know where it is. And, you know, in the nighttime, I can basically keep my eyes closed. I can reach out. I can get something, whatever. And then you just know where everything is all the time when you need it. One thing I do is I try and just be super efficient in the first 20 minutes when I arrive at camp. So within the first 20 minutes, I will make my sleeping platforms. That's like Therm-a-Rest, mattress, whatever. Sleeping bag is out, like airing or drying if it's damp. All the kit in my bag is out if it needs to be out, in the tent, in the right place. Head torches is out. Obviously, in the middle of the afternoon, it's out, like in the hood of my sleeping bag or wherever you want to put it. And then once that's all done, during that time, the stove is probably already on. Like that will probably be on before I even put the tent up. So then by the time the tent is up, I'm having a brew, which is the best thing. And then I'll be straight in and it's 5 minutes of personal admin. It's like base layer off, dry base layer on, maybe a quick wet white wash, socks off, new socks on. And then within 20 minutes, like I am a new person. I've got a cup of tea in my hand. I'm clean and fresh. All my stuff is ready to go. And I can just go and sit on a rock and enjoy the view or help other people or whatever needs to be done. And it is amazing after a huge day when you feel a bit broken, if you can dig really, really deep, be bothered and do that like 20 minutes, then somehow you have this whole new lease of life and energy and appreciation for the day. And then you were talking about this, and sometimes you look around after that 20 minutes because you've just been ferreting around and having a cup of tea and everything's done, and people are still sat with their bag like still on, just like slumped on the floor, having not moved since they got to camp. And you're just like, what are you doing? Like every second that goes past, you're making it harder for yourself. So that'd be my top tip for campcraft, is when you get into camp, just get straight on it. Don't even stop. Put the stove on, put the tent up, get your stuff in, sleeping bag out, personal admin for 5 minutes, wet base layers off, socks off, have a cup of tea. You're a new person.
Totally. Cool. And then getting towards the end of my long list of specifics, emergency evacuation and medical. So there is a whole episode on this from some people who specialize in it. People like Waldo Etherington, Aldo Kane, Megan Hine. But when it comes to the mountain environment, what are the specifics? You know, I recognize that it is a very unique environment when it comes to rescue and evacuation. What do people who haven't done a lot of this but want to get into it need to have thought about?
In most major mountain environments, there will be some sort of heli rescue. And heli rescues by nature are not cheap, but they are kind of your lifeline if you're remote or very high and things go a bit Pete Tong often. So you definitely need to have comprehensive sort of heli search and rescue and evac, which is easily attainable from companies like Global Rescue and BMC and some other folk. So that would be a given. And then I guess really there's quite a few other elements that you can add in. I mean, one that's really important to me that is not like it is tangible, but it's not a physical thing, is building a relationship with my clients that gets to the point where there is no problem with complete honesty. So by that, I mean, when we're pushing for the summit and we're 200 meters from the top and they feel crap, they'll tell me. And if there's nothing I can do about it in that moment, other than go down, that's what we do and that's okay. So for me, that's kind of really important. Being in these serious environments and having spent time invested with the clients during the trek and during base camp and all the rest of it, so that we have a two-way relationship of trust and respect. And that is pretty invaluable. But talking about this with your team members during the trek-in or prior to going is really valuable, so that you have some sort of, even if it's very vague plan, like what ifs, you know, how do we do this? What if? So it depends what country you're in, what options you may have. But as I said, in most major mountain environments, there would be helicopter rescue. And nowadays, a lot of people carry things like Garmin inreaches, or in the old days, like EPIRBs. And as long as that has a subscription and is up to date, then you can press that magic button, hold tight, and hopefully in some given time frame, somebody will come and find you. But I think there's a lot that can be done in the moment with people around you. So in a high mountain environment, I always say that insurance is great, but once you're above 7,000, you're on your own anyway, because helicopters won't pick you up above that. So the three things that will keep you alive are some strong Sherpas or strong teammates around you who are happy to sacrifice whatever it takes to help each other. The high altitude drugs like dexamethasone and nifedipine and Dimox and oxygen. And those three things are your safety net if you're going high in the mountains.
I don't want to put anybody off, but you know, there are all of the other risks in the mountains. You know, there's the avalanche risk, there's the rockfall risk, there's the, you know, you can't really make mistakes when it comes to rope work, et cetera, risk. You can't just go, oh, my skis popped off. It doesn't work like that in the mountains. And I'm conscious of, well, like I say, not putting anybody off, but also empowering people to get out there and start experiencing these things. And whether somebody's interested in potentially becoming an IFMGA mountain guide one day, or more likely with this series, I would argue, whether they're interested in going on an expedition as part of a group to do a piece of research or field science or something like that, what training and skills can they go and find? What sort of level should they look for and where can they find it?
I mean, the level of sort of pre-skilling would depend on the objective in hand. But certainly if you were going polar, then you could consider going to places like Greenland, Iceland, Norway, and doing something that's more accessible and on a smaller scale. And again, like we touched on before, sort of building that up. So it could be like, you could start with like a 2-day, one night sort of thing and build that up and layer up the skills over time. But for sort of mountain environments, there's a plethora of options. You know, we've got the National Mountain Centres in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, Lake District. Here it's Plassey Brennan in North Wales, where I am. And they offer the entire array of skills from sort of first time in the hills, and they call them sort of mountain skills. So right down at the sort of early days of wanting to get out and about, right through to sort of like, you think you know it all, but sort of right top level, sort of, they call them performance climbing, whether it's winter or summer, and you'll end up with sort of absolute top draw world-class instructors, and they will be able to teach you more things than you could ever dream of. And everything in between. And as we touched on before, I think there's so much value in upskilling wherever you are on your sort of career or path in the outdoors. And especially if you're going to go to somewhere new, whether it's jungles or deserts or Arctic or mountains, you'll get more from your experience when you're there if you're able to enjoy that environment because you have some skills before you get there.
Thanks for listening. For more information on how to get started with planning your own expedition or field research project, head to rgs.org. This podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft, produced and edited by Laura J. Cock for Terra Incognita Publishing, and Shane Windsor and Laura Melville for the Royal Geographical Society.